giving a little background how you got into the Saturn program, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I... let me get a couple of notes here, if you want to turn them
off. Okay, yeah.
Well, let's see, in 1966, I was assigned as deputy senior director to the Saturn Apollo program. And it was at that time I was deputy to Ted Smith, who you have interviewed. In 1968, I became the senior director and assistant general manager for the Saturn Apollo programs. Mm-hmm. Well, I carried that work on, and later on also took on the Apollo applications program, which turned out to be the orbital workshop and Skylab. And in 1970, I took on my present assignment, which is executive assistant to the vice president, general manager of McDonnell Douglas Astronautics Company West. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I got into the Apollo program.
Were you involved in, as I remember in some of that stuff you mentioned, Thor? Were you involved in Thor programs, for example, before 66?
Yes, indeed.
One of the things we're interested in is where the technology originated. And Thor apparently played at least a factor the S-4 to start out.
Well, yes, the Thor program began in, I guess it was about 1955 or 1956. Mm-hmm. By 1957, I was the project engineer on the Thor effort at the Edwards Rocket Base. That was the missile static test site at Edwards Rocket Base, where we conducted the static tests on an engine stand, which was called Stand 1-5. We also ran full engineering development tests and environmental tests on for the entire Thor missile on Stand 1-2. After that, and by 1959, I became the project engineer of the ground support equipment for Thor and spent several months in England setting up the requirements for site installation in the United Kingdom. So the foundation of the type of work that was later to be done on S4 and S4B sort of got started on Thor as far as we were concerned. Thor was a liquid oxygen kerosene propellant type of device, whereas S4 and S4B were liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. So there was a major technical improvement by the use of liquid hydrogen as the fuel. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge of how to handle liquid hydrogen was first experienced with us on the S4 program.
Mm-hmm. What about, what was the biggest contribution of Thor, for example, in structures, the waffling of the interior tanks, or what?
Well, it was a precursor of the lightweight, high-strength tanks. The waffle plate design is a fairly efficient design for propellant tanks. It's one that we have followed in the S4 and S4B technology. And we did get our early experience on it in the Thor. We use that technique as a sort of a basic building block, whether they be 45-degree waffle patterns or different, it's essentially the same thing.
Was Thor the first one that ever used that, at least in missiles, that particular type of construction?
Well, I'm not sure that it was the first use. It was certainly one of the early uses. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Were you able to use some of the same machine tools that did those waffle plates? You had to come up with a new set.
No, the size factor caused us to go to bigger machines.
Mm-hmm.
The technology, the basic technology is essentially the same. As I recall, on Thor, we started chemical milling. And then on S4 and S4B, it's a machine milled technique.
Mm-hmm. Does the machine give better tolerances? You have more control over it?
Oh, no, it's just a matter of efficiency. When you're cutting out so much metal as you are on the larger tanks like S4 and S4B, it's just less expensive to go to machine milling.
Yeah. Was this the waffle construction, was that one of the major or the only contribution, say, of Thor to the S4 programs, or were there other things?
No, the major contribution, I would say, was the awareness of how to handle cryogenics and the liquid type of propulsion system that came out of the Thor history.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, do you want to say some more about that?
Well, I was just going to say that on a liquid-propelled system, there's so much involved in pressurizing tanks, pneumatic systems for closing valves and opening valves and getting right valve timing and feed ducts and all of these associated things that are, in a sense, external to the rocket engine, but intimately associated with making the total propulsion system work.
Mm-hmm. Should I sit right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, fine.
Okay, the one thing that strikes me, though, that the Thor, for example, was a LOX technology. When you got the S4B, you were into LH2. Did you go to Convair and have much discussion with them about the LH2 business? Because the Centaur program?
There was certainly an exchange of knowledge from the Centaur program. Much of this you sort of have to learn yourself.
Mm-hmm. Did you exchange, for example, working drawings, or you just went down and talked to the engineers and got some inputs, a few concepts?
It was a combination of both. It was mostly visits and technical discussions.
Uh-huh. What about common bulkheads? Did any of that information from Centaur help at all, or did you have to come up with a new design again?
Well, in our case, it was an entirely new design. The concept of the common bulkhead is one which is intended to save both weight and length.
Yeah.
And we moved into the common bulkhead design concept and found it to be a very efficient technique, although it took a lot of work in getting the problems ironed out to make sure we had a leak-tight bulkhead, one that would not transmit any or permit any excursion of fluids from one side to the other, even though they were small particles.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Yes. Okay. Well, did the Centaur, let's see, as far as the common bulkhead, did the Centaur have sort of a vacuum seal in between the two facings?
Well, both of them do. You want to draw a vacuum or put an inert gas between the two containing surfaces, because the temperature in there gets extremely cold. And if, for example, if you had just a mixture of air,
mm-hmm.
atmospheric air in there, that would get so cold it would liquefy and begin to create icing problems and structural problems due to the fact of the air being converted to liquid, liquid air, and it just is an unhealthy situation in the bulkhead. So you do want to either evacuate it by drawing a vacuum down, capping it off, or filling it with a gas such as argon.
Mm-hmm.
at low pressure. It just makes a much better seal and prevents any structural difficulties.
But in Douglas's approach to the common bulkhead problem, you did come up with some the honeycomb.
Well, the honeycomb is a separation for the two, does two things. It separates the two aluminum domes, provides the insulating characteristics, and then you can draw a vacuum down, and it's sort of like a thermos jug type of thing. So it becomes a thermal barrier because the liquid hydrogen is extremely cold, and relatively speaking, the liquid oxygen is quite hot. So the thermal barrier that is then made by the honeycomb between the two faces of aluminum becomes a very efficient thermal barrier as well as a structural barrier. And the secret of that is to draw a vacuum down or have argon gas or something like that at low pressure, near vacuum conditions.
Was the honeycomb stuff something that was available? You had to some research on that.
We had considerable experience in honeycomb fabrication from previous work. In fact, we had built up a technical capability of aluminum-faced honeycomb for structural members for aircraft use as well as industrial use.
What aircraft was that used in?
Well, they've been used in the technique of a honeycomb between two structural surfaces has been used on things like Nike Zeus, Nike Hercules, as I recall. It makes a good, efficient structural member for things like large wings, or panels, slaw panels, for example. As I recall, our honeycomb type of device. It's extremely rigid and lightweight. We had quite a bit of experience in building honeycomb panels. So the problem now was to make one that was sort of spherical in nature, if you will, or would fit between the two domes that become the common bulkhead.
More and more, it strikes me, seeing this, is that the question, I guess, is how much really state-of-the-art advance occurred in the Saturn program? So often it seems it just was a use of accretions that had already existed, really. It's just
Well, I think that's correct. Let's just take a look at the main structural configuration here on this chart. Now, the liquid hydrogen tank is, for all practical purposes, not just a large Thor tank. The trick on this is the long longitudinal welding seams. I would say that the biggest thing we had to learn on S4 and S4B was how to make, if you will, immaculate welds. The precision of controlling all of the various parameters in running a longitudinal weld seam of this nature was the key to it. We would control one parameter and then control another parameter and get tighter control on other parameters until we finally got to the point where the welds were truly excellent.
Were the Thor tanks then also welded longitudinally?
Yes. But not near the number of seams, nor was the requirement on the integrity of the weld anywhere near as rigid as it was on the S4B.
Was the integrity requirement higher because you were using LH2? Or is this a difference, say, for example, in the space program as opposed to Thor as a military vehicle?
Well, no, the answer, let me answer it in this fashion. It was the specific structural requirements of the S4B, you know, requiring a more efficient system because of the liquid hydrogen and because of the size and the different pressures that were being used.
Mm-hmm.
It was a more demanding technical job, whether it had been NASA-oriented or military-oriented, it had nothing to do with it. It just that the size and the application and the required a much better quality of weld, the
mm-hmm.
reduced porosity, absence of inclusions, much better control on feed rate, much better atmospheric control and around the weld area, and just in short, just much greater precision control of the entire welding operation was required.
Yeah, excuse me, I don't know that much about welding. When you talk about atmospheric control, are you talking about a clean room or just the inert gas process?
Put an inert gas around the
yeah.
the arc welding to keep contaminants out of the puddle.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that you're not introducing any chemicals into the molten metal that is being welded, the fusing process that's going on. So this is done by using inert gas about the flame.
Mm-hmm. This is the MIG process that you used here.
It's yeah. TIG, tungsten and gas.
Well, use the TIG process.
As I recall, we did. We can check with when Adrian gets here. It's been so long since I've been worried about welding problems that I almost forgot.
Yeah, I think this is one of the questions I had here. That it stuck in my mind that Douglas preferred to use the MIG process because they'd used it before on aircraft structures. And Marshall kind of wanted Douglas people to go to the TIG process.
No, there was endless debates at one time, but we finally ended up, and I'm pretty sure it is the TIG process. And we became quite proficient
mm-hmm.
At welding. I think we're very proud of our weld capability.
Mm-hmm. And you used the 2014 T6 skins on this thing?
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
I can check mm-hmm. that in just a second.
If I recall too from my notes here, I think I had some stuff on that. And that's the 2014 was something that was kind of special with space materials, wasn't it? Because of its lightness or its cryogenic characteristics.
It's just a good, honest material that lends itself to the manufacturing process and does not lend itself to things like fatigue and stress corrosion,
mm-hmm.
things of that nature. It's
mm-hmm.
a pretty good piece, type of material for this application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excuse me, we got off on wells here. I mm-hmm. keep interrupting, so let's go ahead with your,
Well, the next thing we really had to learn to do is how to make these large domes. We did not have this sort of a design problem on Thor. The domes on Thor were a different type of approach, but these spherical domes required large welding fixtures and welding techniques.
Mm-hmm.
The real trick of this whole thing basically was the gaining of the knowledge and expertise in a repeatable fashion for the welding process.
Mm-hmm.
Having mastered that after many hard months of working at the problem, that became well controlled and became a technical capability that we had well in hand, and from then on our welding process was fine and we weren't worried about other problems.
Do you remember at the beginning of the program when you were developing this technology, what kind of a rejection rate you had?
Well, yes, the rejection rate is usually reported the number of repairs that have to be done on a weld seam. Or another way of looking at it is how many inches of weld can you do that are considered to be of the necessary quality when measured by x-rays, dye penetration devices, and visual inspection.
Did you ever use a Magnaflux technique on this, or is that, no, that's aluminum, wouldn't lend itself to it, would it? Yeah.
We would map all of the wells, and we were scored, if you want to look at it that way, by the reducing the number of corrections that had to be done. And by correcting, I mean grinding out, rewelding, and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, the number of corrections that were involved on any one weld seam were relatively minor in nature. There are always a few, but instead of looking like having a large population of corrections, we ended up with having a small number of corrections.
Mm-hmm. How do you, after the tank was finished, can you tell us a little bit about how the testing process used?
Yes.
A hydrostatic test?
Yes, we use a hydrostatic test, which is location just off of this chart.
Yeah, I think I remember. I think we went through that building.
Very large tank where we put the pressure vessel into the tank. We have water on outside and inside, and then pressurize a small ullage up to the required loads. And the reason for that is that if you test in a water tank of this nature, if there is a failure, it's not a catastrophic failure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just blow it up like a balloon and it lets go at 30 or 40 psi, why, it's a king-size bang.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, it seems to me, I remember that North American people were talking about such a test, and they had wound up with water all over their lot. But you had water on both sides of the tank, or you just...
Yes.
Yeah. So that eliminated that problem. Excuse me, I'm not looking at my watch because I'm checking to see that we've got time left on the tape here. Yeah. And this is the top of the aft dome here.
Well, that's the top of the common bulkhead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah, yeah.
And that's also the top of the liquid oxygen tank.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can go through a couple of pictures here. This is the Panduris welding jig, which is right here.
Yeah.
And this is used to make these longitudinal seams. There are seven segments of skin that have been formed of the right curvature. And these are the waffle plates, waffle pattern. And there are these long runs of weld from here to here,
mm-hmm.
fore and aft. The welded cylindrical tank is then put in this large device here where it's trimmed and is made ready for accepting the top bulkhead, which we call the forward dome on the liquid hydrogen tank, and is ready to accept the liquid oxygen tank.
Excuse me, man, on this Panduris thing. Now, is that a machine tool that originates locally, or where did you get the machinery to build the...
We developed that with the Panduris company and applied it to our particular requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the main features that I think are highlighted here are associated with constant improvement of the controls of the various parameters that are associated with doing a good weld,
mm-hmm.
like feed rate, proper handling of the welding rod as it is fed to the weld puddle, the control of the electrical current during the welding process, the control of the atmosphere around the weld, and mm-hmm. I would say that also the fact that we record all of these parameters so that years later we can go back and determine just exactly what were the essential characteristics of the parameters involved in any weldment on any stage at any place. These are all available, these mm-hmm. records.
Did you take, for example, photographs of these things, motion picture photographs, I'm talking of the operation, so that if you ever had to retool, these films could be used as a training device?
We have not done that. Other people have. We mm-hmm. we are considering doing it, but we have not gotten to that point.
Yeah.
We think it's a good idea.
Yeah. The, where is this Panjuris company located? Can you remember offhand?
No, but I can find
out. Is it a Cleveland area? I'm just wondering what...
Don't know.
Yeah, okay. Because this is one of the things, again, that struck John Belts and myself, my colleague. You know, where does the tools to make a rocket stage, where do they originate?
Well, it's a combination of the technology from a company such as the Panjuris Company and our own people. We get together and looking at the specific application, and out of this comes the design and the process and the methods involved.
Had you used a Panjuris welder on the Thor, for example?
Not precisely this type, but a similar type. We had to do longitudinal seams on the Thor.
I remember seeing the welder out in the shops. Can you use that in any other process, or is it good for S4 and S4Bs only?
At the moment, it's good for S4Bs only.
Yeah.
If it's possible that it might be adapted for shuttle type of work,
mm-hmm.
that'll be known when the shuttle configuration is finally established.
Yeah. Excuse me here, I'll check my, the problem with this, it looks like we're doing okay yet. This thing does not have a counter on it, so I can't tell how many feet are left. Oh yeah, this is, yeah, they're laying it in here, for the insulation.
You may want to look, here's how we put the curvature to those cylindrical sections that become mm-hmm. the liquid hydrogen tank. That's a very large press at Long Beach. And that is used to achieve the curvature that's required. And this is a fairly precision operation, even though that piece of aluminum sheet is some 20 plus feet long and mm-hmm. 10 feet wide.
It's a Verzin brake, is that what that is?
Yes.
And the Verzin is a trade press, trade name, yeah. Okay, is that... automatically taped to shape that, or how do you figure the configuration of the curve there? How does that thing operate? Do you have any idea?
I'm not familiar with that part of the operation. I'm sorry.
Now, what happens when you put this grid pattern into a curvature configuration? You get kind of crackings and seams?
No,
so what does it do to the strength of the plates there?
Well, about all it would ever do to it is just do a little work hardening, and it'll end up being a little stronger. Because uh-huh. you don't, you have to go to the yield, of course, in order to get the permanent set in the sheet, but you don't go to a point where you begin to induce cracks.
Yes, excuse me again. Now, is this a unique piece of equipment, or
yes,
is this the...
it's unique by virtue of its size.
Uh-huh.
It is used... for large aircraft wing panels.
Now? Uh-huh.
It lends itself to things like the DC-8 and the mm-hmm. DC-10.
Did you have any equipment like this Verzin press before, or this was the first time you tried this?
No, this came about as a result of the DC-8 activity.
And then you used it for the S4 and 4B?
Mm-hmm.
I see. So you were making wing panels on it, and then you just started making S4B things? Huh. Well, that's very interesting. You didn't go into any kind of explosive forming at all?
No. We are familiar with the technique and have used it in other areas, but mm-hmm. we did not use it on this stage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, these are the vertical checkout towers over here. I may be getting just a little bit ahead of the story, but in the balconies behind these walls is a very complex computer-controlled checkout facility, which makes a 100% check of all electrical operations, all signals changing, all changes of state, valve positions, and things of that nature, and gets a full recording of all of the parameters associated with those activities, so that we can determine that the system or the subsystems and down to the components are functioning properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, did Douglas develop a kind of a unique programming system for this, or were there attempts to standardize so that you were doing the same kinds of checkouts, say, as Boeing?
Well, the basics are essentially the same. The applications rapidly become different because of the different characteristics of the stages involved.
Yeah.
Now, for example, Boeing with five F1 engines would have essentially the basic problem to solve. The details of solving it would be a little different.
Right, because, again, you're using a different engine on the S4 and 4B2. Yeah.
And it's they've got five, we have one.
Mm-hmm.
But the basics are pretty much the same. The thing you want to do here is to tell the computer, through programming techniques, to check the things you want and record the responses once those checks have been made. And then you want to be able to get a readout which permits you to determine whether the responses are correct in the right time slots and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Would the space program have been possible without a computer?
It may have been possible, but it would have been a lot more laborious. And I imagine there are people who might rightfully say it would not have been possible without the computer. Certainly when you